Support for the World's Podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Nearly 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom to start their businesses, with LLCs, incorporation, and more. But even after your business is set up, LegalZoom can still help you out. Things like lease agreements, changing tax laws, and contract reviews are all part of running your own business. And these are precisely the kinds of costly hurdles that can take time away from growing your business. That's why LegalZoom created their business legal plan. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan at LegalZoom.com now and get special savings when you enter the word world at checkout. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com.
A quick note before we start the show. This is your last chance to make a gift to PRI's The World during our spring fundraiser. Visit theworld.org/gift to help us unlock $30,000 in challenge funds today. Thank you very much for your support. Accuracy matters today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. U.S.-led airstrikes in Raqqa, Syria killed hundreds of civilians, but the U.S. government did not count them accurately.
No forensic follow-ups, no investigations, no interviews with eyewitnesses and survivors and so on.
Also, another cyclone slams into Mozambique just weeks after the last one.
Cyclone Idai, just to give an example, was one of the worst disasters in the country's history, and now we're seeing a second disaster making landfall as we speak.
Plus, if you think distraction is a modern problem, turns out even medieval monks had trouble staying focused.
They also would have issues with boredom. They just would stare out the window or wonder what time it was.
No smartphones to blame either. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Earlier this year, President Trump declared victory over ISIS after the terror group was kicked out from its last stronghold in Syria. Today, we hear stunning news about the human costs of the fight against ISIS. Amnesty International and the monitoring group Air Wars studied the effects of a U.S.-led air assault on Raqqa, the self-declared ISIS capital in Syria. That was in 2017, and they concluded the assault killed more than 1,600 civilians, 10 times what government officials reported. Chris Woods is the founder of Air Wars, and he joins us now from London. How could the military be off by so much?
I think the challenge that we've had with the US-led coalition, and these were primarily US air and artillery strikes that drove ISIS out of Raqqa, is that they haven't been on the ground themselves. They have not carried out any ground investigations since the defeat of ISIS in that city. And so it's been left to NGOs and monitors to pick up the slack.
So you're saying that because the US war was an air war, they were just guessing at the casualties on the ground?
It was an air and artillery war. Many times, the coalition simply didn't know where the civilians were. There were tens and tens of thousands of civilians trapped in the city, mostly hiding. And most civilians died when the buildings they were in collapsed down on top of them.
So buildings collapsed and killed the people hiding inside them. The report says the cases your group documented could amount to human rights violations.
Well, we've identified almost 500 individual civilian harm events that took place in Raqqa, according to the local population. And it's certainly our contention that some of those events would appear to have violated the laws of war, particularly around the questions of proportionality and distinction. If we don't know where the civilians are, and we can't distinguish between civilian and combatant, which was often the case at Raqqa, the laws of war are under severe pressure, and that's what we believe happened.
How did you actually get your data?
Amnesty was on the ground for approximately 2 months, multiple field investigations, interviewing hundreds of eyewitnesses and survivors, documenting, videoing sites of attack and so on. Air Wars had also collected, during the Battle of Raqqa, reports from the ground. We'd archived that material, almost 500 alleged incidents from Raqqawis themselves. And then we crowdsourced thousands of volunteers who assessed more than 2 million satellite images to help us determine where and when some 11,000 buildings in Raqqa had been destroyed or severely damaged. So when we put all of that information together alongside our dialogue with the coalition over the last year or two, and indeed the cases the coalition had confirmed already for Raqqa, we built up this very substantial understanding of civilian harm, which as the report says, is approximately 10 times greater than the coalition itself is conceding.
Yeah, as you know, the Pentagon has said repeatedly it takes great care to avoid civilian casualties. Have you spoken with the Pentagon about this, and what did they say?
Well, we've been in contact with the coalition today. They have put out a lengthy statement, and they say that they are looking at the allegations in our report. We're encouraged by that. In fact, just today, in their latest regular monthly civilian casualty report, the coalition conceded a further 15 deaths during the Battle of Raqqa. Both of the incidents that they conceded were originally Air Wars referrals. So they do take Air Wars and Amnesty seriously. We are looking forward to engaging with them on these many cases that we looked at, and to see if they'll substantially review their estimates of civilian harm at Raqqa. It's important that they get this right. Undercounting civilian deaths by a factor of 10 is in nobody's interest.
Chris Woods, the founder of Air Wars, speaking with us from London. Thank you.
Thank you.
Authorities in Sri Lanka today lowered the death toll from the bombings there last Sunday. But we're still talking a large number, more than 250 people killed in the attacks. Meanwhile, we're learning more about the bombers themselves, 8 men and 1 woman, according to officials. 2 of the attackers have been identified as brothers, the sons of a wealthy spice merchant who were both educated abroad. That surprised a lot of people, including the Prime Minister of Sri Lanka. Mia Bloom is an expert on extremism at Georgia State University. She says the brothers do fit a certain profile.
One of the standard operating procedures for the jihadi groups is to use members of the same family. We had the Tsarnaev brothers in Boston. We had the Kouachi brothers in France. In the Dubrovka theater attack by the Chechens in 2002, there were 19 suicide bombers, and there were as many as 11 sets of siblings. So the sibling connection is a hallmark, not just of terrorist groups in general, but it is particularly embraced by these jihadi groups. And they do that for a variety of reasons, but one is to maintain operational secrecy. They know that the brother's not going to rat out on his brother or the sister on her sister, but also they're not going to change their mind at the last minute and thereby disappoint their sibling.
What about the apparent affluence of these suspected attackers? Did that surprise you?
You may be familiar with the late Alan Krueger at Princeton University. In 2002, Krueger co-authored a piece showing how there was a reverse or an inverse relationship between poverty and terrorism. While we tend to associate the ills of poverty as maybe one of the reasons for radicalization, in fact, if you look at the 9/11 bombers or if you look at terrorists in general, we often see people not only who are disproportionately educated, but also quite wealthy. So it shouldn't surprise people. The other part of it is that the 32 Sri Lankans who joined ISIS, many were doctors or engineers. There's a fantastic book by Diego Gambetta called Engineers for Jihad, which shows that the jihadi groups disproportionately attract educated people in the hard sciences.
I mean, it's still not clear if the bombers were actually ISIS or just inspired by ISIS. What do you think the evidence points to?
I've spent the last 3.5 years studying ISIS propaganda, and we collect the propaganda every single day. There's certain kinds of markings and brandings on ISIS propaganda videos that show that it's definitely ISIS directed. ISIS was very slow to claim the attack compared to, say, the attack in Bangladesh or the attack against the Iranian parliament. In those attacks, which were directed, the attackers had GoPro cameras on and you could watch the attack in real time, and ISIS was disseminating this. This was slower, and so I can feel fairly confident it was ISIS inspired. This also is one of the things that ISIS has been preparing. They post how-to videos, not just how to build a bomb, but where to stab on a person's body that's going to cause the most damage. As the caliphate territorially has declined, they have increased their desire to project their power throughout the world.
What do you think the highly organized nature of the attacks in Sri Lanka tells us about this group? I mean, multiple cities, several different targets.
In order to have a coordinated attack of this sophistication, you need more than a handful of days. I was a little circumspect about blaming Christchurch. My suspicion is that the attacks were originally planned against Buddhist targets. there had been some sectarian violence in late 2018. There had been defacings of Buddhist statues that led to rioting against the Muslim communities in Sri Lanka. But then after Christchurch, I think it was switched. Instead of going to a Buddhist temple, they send them to a church. And then they coordinate it for maximum carnage the morning of Easter.
So these suspected attackers in Sri Lanka, because of what we know now, probably had resources, right? They had money. How does that change the narrative of planning this coordinated attack?
Well, if the individual bombers come from families with means, they don't necessarily need to have money coming from outside. I think that's going to be one of the things that the Sri Lankan security services are going to have to look at. Were they self-funded because they were coming from wealthy families, or did they get some startup money from abroad? But we also know from 9/11 that the most expensive elements of 9/11 were the airplane tickets. The bombs themselves are not necessarily expensive to fabricate. One of the things that has been suggested is that because Sri Lanka has a long history with suicide bombing with the Tamil Tigers, that maybe this technology or know-how was fairly widespread.
Do you think Islamic extremism and far-right extremism are starting to feed off each other?
Absolutely. There's so many commonalities when you look at the kinds of people that are attracted to these groups, the kinds of images that they share, the kinds of ideologies. They hate Jewish people. They hate gay people. They hate liberals. They hate women. I mean, it is really interesting to see the overlap. But I also think that there's a call and response, because the moment you have an extreme right wing conduct an operation which will incentivize jihadis to conduct an operation, which then justifies the extreme right wing's xenophobia, hatred of refugees, or hatred of Muslims, it just goes back and forth and keeps ramping up with every iteration. And these echo chambers are really feeding off of one another.
Mia Bloom, professor at Georgia State University, thanks very much, as always.
Marco, thank you for having me.
Remember Hurricane Irma? That was a storm that preceded Hurricane Maria in 2017, slamming islands in the Caribbean. A 1-2 punch. Residents of Mozambique and southern Africa are facing themselves a 1-2 punch right now. Cyclone Kenneth follows Idai, making it the second massive cyclone to hit Mozambique in the last 6 weeks. Katie Wilkes is with the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. She's in Mozambique right now. I gather the cyclone made landfall evening local time. Where are you, Katie, and what can you tell us about the impact of Kenneth so far?
So right now I'm in Beira, Mozambique. I've been here for the past 4 weeks in response to Cyclone Idai. And what we know right now is that Cyclone Kenneth is on its way to make landfall in the northern part of the country. So right now we do have Red Cross and Red Crescent volunteers and staff pre-positioned, which has allowed us to go out into the communities to give them proper warning and to make sure that we're there during what is proving to be a pretty destructive storm.
Well, I'm glad to hear people are in place, but I gather that the storm intensified really quickly, like going from a tropical storm to a Cat 4 cyclone in just 36 hours. So how much were people there, Mozambicans, caught by surprise?
So this is, first of all, a country that is incredibly resilient, and cyclones are definitely not a new thing for this country. That being said, what we are seeing the past several weeks has been considered unprecedented. Cyclone Idai was one of the worst disasters in the country's history, and now we're seeing a second disaster.
As you say, this is unprecedented. So what about the future? Because all the prognoses are that climate change is making tropical storms more intense, pushing up sea levels, then things get even worse. How are leaders in Mozambique thinking about or preparing for this new future?
So obviously, a lot of these storms being back to back is causing a lot of anxiety for locals here in the country. And after a cyclone, our concerns are always along the lines of flooding, erosion, landslides. So we're really there to help these people through the hardest times of their lives, both prepare before that storm hit, but also during the response and well into the recovery phase that will last many, many months afterwards.
Katie, as you said, you're in Beira. That's a city of 500,000. The community was 90% destroyed by last month's cyclone, Idai. I gather a lot of people, maybe the entire city, is homeless. How has recovery there been going, and what are the concerns for progress after Kenneth?
Yeah, so it's now 6 weeks after the worst disaster, Cyclone Idai, in Mozambique's history. And we're seeing people starting to return back home. We are seeing the cholera outbreaks starting to wind down. However, I will say the response is definitely far from over. We've got still hundreds of thousands of people who need sustained long-term support to help rebuild, but also for the psychosocial, emotional component as well.
Katie Wilkes with the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. She's been speaking with us from Beira, Mozambique, as Cyclone Kenneth starts to slam the country. Thank you very much, Katie. Stay safe.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Of Cathedrals and Homelessness, Anger Over Inequality in France. That's next, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. French President Emmanuel Macron vowed to cut middle-class taxes, one of the promises he made today in a national address. This was Macron's long-awaited response to months of anti-government yellow vest protests.
Aujourd'hui, l'ordre public doit revenir avant tout. Et avec lui, l'indispensable...
Macron said he would bring back order to the French Republic. The most recent protest focused on the money pledged to rebuild the Notre Dame Cathedral, $1 billion. That angered many French who'd rather see that money go to addressing more pressing issues. The World's Lucy Martirosian is with me in the studio. She's been following the story. Hey, Lucy.
Hi, Marco.
So, Lucy, there have been protests over all of this at Notre Dame. What have those protests actually looked like?
So it started with Gilets Jaunes, you know, the yellow vest protesters, and they've been out on the streets for months now. And then it moved on to right to housing organizations earlier this week, and these were the chants.
€1 billion for Notre Dame, zero for homeless people.
That's the gist of it, yeah.
So you spoke with two people from the French Right to Housing Association who were at these protests. What did they say?
Yeah, I spoke with Françoise Chenillard and Marie Huibon. I was saying that €1 billion mostly comes from the French and international billionaires. What does the state have to do with this? And Françoise told me that the state is responsible too.
The state and the local collectivities or municipalities keep saying that there's no money to finance social housing, that they have to implement austerity policies. And there's no money, we cannot build. And all of a sudden, we see there's €1 billion.
So Françoise, she's saying that the French government is prioritizing funds for Notre Dame, but not for ongoing social issues like homelessness. Her colleague Marie calls this economic inequality.
C'est un exemple d'inégalité. Pour le toit de Notre-Dame, il y a un milliard d'euros.
So Marie's saying that homeless people not only get nothing out of this, but the law that currently exists isn't serving them. She says that that's shocking and indecent.
What is the law that she's referring to?
It's called DALO, that's droit au logement opposable in French, or the right to affordable housing. It prioritizes allocation for people in vulnerable housing situations like homelessness or domestic violence situations. France is actually the first and only European country with a law that directly enforces a right to housing.
So that's why the Right to Housing Association went to protest at Notre Dame, because this law is not being implemented?
Right. So for Marie and Françoise, they see an example of the problem right down the street from Notre Dame. There's currently 150 people staying at a gymnasium, a temporary shelter, near Élysée Palace. And that's where President Emmanuel Macron lives. And at least 40 of these people, Françoise and Marie told me, are completely homeless. They've been there for the past 3 months now, and some of them are eligible for DALO, the law, and should have found housing by now.
So it's not asking for charity or anything. It's just the demands are that the laws are enforced.
Lucy, how bad is homelessness these days in France?
Yeah, Marco, it is pretty bad. And there was this preliminary report that was done by the UN this month that showed access to housing is nearly impossible in France these days. Housing prices and rental costs are on the rise. Shelters are at capacity. This report says that there's been nearly a 60% increase of homelessness between 2001 and 2012. That's 11 years. And the UN expects it to get worse.
Yeah, so it sounds like there is a problem. Are the Right to Housing Association and other groups going to continue protesting at Notre Dame?
Françoise and Marie say that as long as these 150 people are still at this gym near the presidential palace, yes, they're going to keep mobilizing.
The World's Lucy Martirosian. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
For more on the economic inequality in France, we called Sophie Petter. She's Paris bureau chief for The Economist. She's also written a biography on President Macron. We heard earlier from Françoise and Marie from the Right to Housing Association there, and they were saying this is all about economic inequality. There's so much attention to this cathedral, this monument, yet there's not enough being done to address homelessness and poverty in France. Do they have a point?
Of course there are issues with poverty and homelessness and housing. There's a huge strain on the housing supply in most big cities in France. But it is not, you know, it is not as bad as it is in some countries. And the state actually does a fair job in making sure that the worst edges are sort of rounded.
But don't people like Françoise and Marie and a lot of the Gilets jaunes, don't they feel like the social safety net has been whittled away at so much in France that they're now at risk?
It's just not the case that the social safety net's been whittled away. And I don't think that's the basis of the Gilets jaunes protests. You know, what was happening when this began last November, it was a protest against the rise of in cost in petrol price. It was a green tax, a carbon tax on car motor fuel at the pump. France does have a social welfare state. I think there is something much bigger that's taking place in France. It's a shift which is going on in countries all over the world. It's a shift towards the hollowing out of jobs for the squeezed middle, you could call it, and therefore the kind of prospect that your children will do better than you has been eroded. So I think that has contributed to a sense that, you know, if you're stuck on a low income, that you are stuck and you don't have a perspective of that moving. That's what a lot of this has been about.
So what do you think the concern about economic inequality in France and the protests of the Gilets jaunes, what does it say about French President Emmanuel Macron and his ability to create confidence in his country people?
I think that he does have a balanced policy, but the perception is not that way. And because this perception has stuck that he is acting on behalf of businesses, rich people, high earners, these sorts of measures are somehow disregarded by public opinion and seen as perhaps too late, perhaps too little. But I don't think they're seen as sincere, which I think is a misreading of what he's trying to do. I think fundamentally, what Emmanuel Macron is trying to do as president is invest in individuals' capacity to improve their lives and to do as good a job as the state can to improve that environment for them.
Sophie Petter with The Economist. Thanks very much for this view from Paris. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Every year, indigenous people in Brazil stage a campout in the capital, Brasilia. Normally, it's not a tense event, but this year the Brazilian government sent riot police to the gathering and tensions are high. My BBC colleague Daniel Gallas went to the camp to get a quick peek at what's going on.
Thousands of indigenous people from all across Brazil are camping out here in Brasilia's vast open spaces next to Congress and the president's office. They are worried that Brazil's new president, Jair Bolsonaro, may have plans to take away some of their lands. The indigenous people in Brazil, they live in reserves that are protected, and Jair Bolsonaro has hinted that he wants to bring big economic activities like mining, agriculture, and hydroelectric dams to indigenous reserves. Native Brazilians are definitely not happy about this.
In the camp, I spoke to Antonio Wilson from the Guajajara ethnic group.
A gente sem nossas florestas, nós não conseguimos viver.
Without a forest, we cannot live. If a person destroys that, he or she doesn't have a heart and is not thinking about the world as a whole. This is a message I want to send out to the world. What we do in terms of defending the forest and the river is a work we do for everyone, for humanity as a whole. What we are doing right now is looking for support, not only in here where we live, but from other countries as well.
Indigenous leader Antonio Wilson speaking there with the BBC's Daniel Gallas in Brasilia. You're with the world. Hey there, listener. This is your last chance to make a gift to PRI's The World during our spring fundraiser. We need to hear from listeners like you to unlock $30,000 in challenge funds to support the journalism you hear every day on the show. And when you set up a monthly recurring donation of $10 or more, you'll be entered to hear your name on the show as a thank you from us. Visit theworld.org/gift to learn more and donate today. Thank you. I'm Marco Werman. In politics, sometimes you just wish there could be a do-over.
Why can't they just do a second Brexit referendum? because it would say to millions who trusted in democracy that our democracy does not deliver.
The power and limits of a referendum. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. What could be more democratic than calling a referendum? You know, asking the people to decide. It's what Egypt just did. Egyptians voted overwhelmingly for constitutional changes that could allow President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to rule until 2030. It's what Ireland is preparing to do next month in a referendum that would regulate divorce. And it's what Britain did, of course, 3 years ago with Brexit. The question then was simple enough, stay in the European Union or leave, except that now it's not so simple, since Parliament's gridlocked over how to leave. Yes, the unintended consequences of a referendum. We'll hear more on that theme in just a bit as we spend the next few minutes on the show on this idea of referendums. First, the reaction from many Brits to this Brexit impasse is, shouldn't there just be a second referendum? You know, another chance for the people to decide. It's not just Brits raising those questions. Here's The World's Sarah Birnbaum.
I don't like telling my friends that I work for an international news show because stuff like this happens.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Should I ask my question?
This is my friend Becca Becht. We met when we were teenagers, and you can hear that we still act that way. But now she's a fancy lawyer in Boston. Okay, back to Becca's question.
Why can't they just do a second Brexit referendum?
I tried my best to answer, but it wasn't pretty. But then I remembered something I heard British Prime Minister Theresa May say about just this issue.
Finally, let us not break faith with the British people by trying to stage another referendum. Yeah. Another vote which would do irreparable damage to the integrity of our politics. Because it would say to millions who trusted in democracy that our democracy does not deliver.
So I sum that up for Becca.
It's undemocratic because, I mean, you can't be seen as taking the referendum is the will of the people, and if you just do a second one, it would be like you're undoing it.
So, but what's the point of taking a measurement of the will of the people through a referendum if you can't do it again? Isn't a newer temperature of the people more valid than an old one?
Yeah, I told you she was a good lawyer.
Okay, let me take this to some British people and see what they say.
Awesome.
And so I called the BBC's Rob Watson, who has the unenviable job of explaining British politics to mainly non-British people.
At this point, the reason why there isn't going to be a second referendum is because the majority of Britain's politicians can't agree that there should be one.
Makes sense. After all, we in the States are no strangers to congressional gridlock. But Rob says that can all change the longer the country's stuck in Brexit purgatory.
As they see the sort of chaos of the Brexit process, you know, you're likely to get more and more MPs switching to say, you know what, uncomfortable as we are with the idea of another vote, maybe it does make more sense.
So all of this is about parliamentary math. But for me, the more interesting question is the philosophical one. Would a second referendum be undemocratic in principle? And for that, I turned to political philosopher Erin Kelly at Tufts University. She said that according to the theory of deliberative democracy, a second referendum would be even more democratic because the people have had time to reflect and come to a more informed decision.
I don't think that a population considering and discussing a very important consequential political question together over time, over the course of 3 years, and reforming their opinion and wanting to express it through a democratic process with a possible different outcome is, in principle, objectionable.
All right. I think it's time to report back to Becca.
Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Bex. Okay, so I have some answers to your referendum questions. Okay, so from what I can tell, they are having an issue getting any kind of clear majority behind it because some MPs are...
So I went over the whole thing.
Vote. Other ones say,
thank you.
You know, let me know if there are any other questions that I can answer for you.
Yeah, actually, I was wondering what is going on with
this comedian who just won a landslide in Ukraine.
Ugh, never tell friends you work at The World. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Okay, so back to that idea of holding a second referendum to decide something the first one didn't quite settle. There's a place where they've tried that, Quebec. The predominantly French-speaking province twice held votes on whether to separate from the rest of Canada and become its own nation. These votes were divisive, but the changes that came in their wake weren't all bad. Emma Jacobs reports from Montreal.
A musician is playing for tourists in front of the Notre-Dame Basilica in the historic center of Montreal. This is where I meet Mario Pelez, an emeritus professor of urban economics at the research institute INRS. He says that a century ago,
this was Canada's Wall Street, St. James Street. It has all these wonderful old buildings with Greek columns, which is what, you know, important and serious banks should look like.
All Canada's major banks and insurance companies had their headquarters here. The people who ran these institutions spoke English, even though most people living in Quebec spoke French. That led to stark income inequality between English speakers and French speakers, which contributed to Quebec nationalism and a separatist movement that grew in the 60s and was even endorsed by French President Charles de Gaulle. It culminated with the victory of the Parti Québécois in 1976 in provincial elections. The party promised a referendum on independence within its first term. But not everyone was happy about this, says Mario Pelez.
Businessmen, and bankers especially, hate uncertainty. You know, hate uncertainty.
If Quebec separated from Canada, could they move their employees easily between cities? Quebec separatists said that they wanted to keep Canadian currency, but if that didn't work out, a Quebec currency would be much weaker.
So if you were a bank, that uncertainty certainly would cause you to think twice about staying here.
The Parti Québécois also passed a law that made French Quebec's only official language, limiting English in workplaces and even on shop signs.
It's difficult to factor out which one is more important, the fear of eventual separation or the fact that all of a sudden the English language had lost its dominant status.
An exodus began. The Sun Life Insurance Company had a towering building here, but in 1978, Sun Life announced it would move its headquarters to Toronto. That English-speaking city was already competing with Montreal for big business. Now other companies followed. In 1980, the separatists had the referendum and lost. Quebec remained part of Canada. But Bay Street in Toronto kept Canada's financial hub. Some 200,000 residents also left Quebec for English-speaking provinces during these years, a brain drain that also hurt Montreal's economy. But Pelez points to the glass towers around us.
In 1960, there was no such thing as a big French-Canadian company. Well, today, where you're standing, you know, French Canada has given rise to a whole bunch of multinationals.
In sectors like insurance, construction, engineering, by the mid-90s, a second referendum on separation had hardly any measurable economic impact. Most companies that would have considered leaving had already done so. They left Montreal, a second-tier financial city, but its overall economy has recovered. And
Quebec succeeded in doing, I call it a miracle. It is a miracle, okay?
That income gap between English speakers and French speakers, he says, has all but disappeared. For The World, I'm Emma Jacobs.
The World's history guy, Chris Wolf, joins me now to talk about, is it referendums or referenda?
Well, I was actually shocked to learn, Marco, it's actually referendums. It's incorrectly assumed that it's a Latin noun, but it's not. It's actually a new English word that was coined a couple of hundred years ago using the word refer and a fancy Latin-sounding ending.
So there's this kind of fake Latin connection to the word referendum, but does that mean that the ancient Romans did not have referendums?
Well, they did kind of. In the Roman Republic, they certainly enjoyed consulting the people. The Senate and the consuls ran the joint, but they, for vitally important questions in the Republic, like war and peace or land reform, they would try and get buy-in from the masses by either the citizens assembling in committee or in the forum itself. By the way, a decree from the Committee of the Plebs is a plebiscite, which is another word for referendum, but it meant something different in the Roman times.
So you gave us the linguistic side of referendum. What exactly is it, anyway?
In one sentence, Marco, a referendum is a vote by the electorate on a single political question.
So were the Romans the first people to make these attempts at direct democracy?
Well, I would think not. Since humans have gathered into bands, it's been smart political leadership to get buy-in for difficult decisions by asking people what they want to do. You know, where are we going to hunt this year? That kind of thing. But the practice obviously wasn't too welcome among kings and princes, so it kind of vanished from organized states once they were established until the 1500s. And that's when we find the first example of a referendum, and in fact the first use of the word in the modern sense, in a little canton in Switzerland called Graubünden. It became quite the thing in Switzerland, in fact, as a confederation of mini-states. They had some of those echoes of Roman and ancient Greece, but it was really only found there until the late 1700s.
And then what happened?
Well, remember the French Revolution?
Your Majesty, I must have a word with you. I have come on the most urgent of business. It is said that the people are revolting.
You said it. They stink on ice.
That's for those of you who get your history of the world from Mel Brooks. But the modern revival of referendums, as it were, came with the advent of the Enlightenment in Europe, the idea of popular sovereignty, that power comes from the consent of the governed, not from God. And the French revolutionaries took this good idea of listening to the will of the people and made it a terrible way to change your constitution. The experience shows, I think, one of those core weaknesses of the referendum, that it's also its main advantage. It's a good way to legitimize dramatic change, for good or bad. And within a few years, referendums were being abused by Napoleon to make himself consul for life and then emperor.
Yeah, so in some circles, referendums are not well regarded.
Not at all. When I was studying politics and government in the 1980s in the UK, they were really frowned on. My teachers could remember voices like this.
In cui Roma aveva Cesare, Virgilio ed Augusto.
Benito Mussolini was dictator of Italy from the 1920s to the 1940s. He turned elections into plebiscites where you could approve or disapprove of a single list of candidates. Then there was this.
When Hitler goes to vote for himself, the cheers speak louder than words. All Germany seems to be anxious to show its solidarity behind the dictator and its approval of his policy.
What policy was that?
Well, in this particular instance, that's the occupation of the Rhineland in defiance of international law in 1936. And I think it's good to remember that Hitler did not have absolute power immediately. He had to progressively demolish constraints on his power and weaken and eliminate other sources of power, whether it's the legislature or the judiciary or the unions or even international law. And one of his tools for doing that was the referendum, the plebiscite. For example, in 1934, a plebiscite was used to merge the offices of president and chancellor.
So not a great history there, but these days referendums seem to be everywhere around the globe.
Well, they seem to have been rehabilitated, but they're still problematic, especially when they're not authorized by a central government, but by, say, a regional minority. In Catalonia in 2017, the celebrations were followed by clashes with police and the imposition of direct rule from Madrid. There was a similar fiasco in Iraqi Kurdistan the same year.
In a controversial and some say illegal vote, 90% of Iraqi Kurds, who have been America's closest partners in the fight, have voted for independence from the Iraqi government.
That vote was eventually ignored, but only after the central government in Baghdad had threatened war. So that's another warning about these referendums. They can be useful, but they're also divisive and dangerous.
What is the U.S. record on referendums, Chris?
Well, of course, the U.S. was born out of that Enlightenment we talked about in Europe and the idea of popular sovereignty, which is the foundation of the U.S. Constitution. Yet the Founding Fathers very deliberately rejected any notion of direct democracy. They very much believed in something quite different, what political scientists call representative democracy, where you elect representatives and they then make their own judgment about issues. So it got off to a slow start. But then in 1898, South Dakota introduces the referendum, and they slowly take off through the western states, now accepted by 24 states in the Union. But of course, there's no provision for a national referendum or even a recall.
Chris, a final thought on referendums? What strikes you?
Well, I think an election or a vote, it's supposed to reflect the will of the people, and that should be respected. But they're only as good as they're designed. For example, a hugely complex question like leaving the European Union, a semi-federal entity, was framed as a simple, like, kind of leave-stay question. So there was enough people wanting to leave. But as we've seen, absolutely no agreement on when or how, which kind of explains how we're in this pickle now.
The world's Chris Wolf. Thank you. Shall we stop chatting now? Yes? No?
Let's let the listeners decide.
You know, if you go digging, there are some pretty odd laws in the books. What is the weirdest referendum you've come across?
Well, I think the prize has to go to Saskatoon in Canada, which in 1997 had the very interesting referendum on to decide in municipal toilets which way the toilet paper should come off the roll. Should it be over or under? One of those key debates of our time. They voted 4-1 in favor of toilet paper coming over. To be serious, they just wanted to test new voting equipment and thought this would be a fun way to try that.
Here's something you probably already know. The latest Marvel blockbuster, Avengers Endgame, is a big deal for Hollywood. Technically opened in the U.S. on Monday, but only in L.A., the movie will be in theaters nationwide tomorrow, but if you haven't already reserved your ticket, you may have to wait a while. If you're in China, though, you could have seen Avengers Endgame yesterday. If you're wondering why Chinese moviegoers get to see it before many of us here in the U.S., well, the answer is money. So says Beth Accomando, film critic at KPBS in San Diego and host of the Cinema Junkie podcast.
China is a huge, huge market. You know, the grosses from China can bump up the worldwide gross for a film by, you know, $100 million. So it is a very important market.
Need proof? Avengers Endgame earned more than $100 million yesterday, a record breaker for an opening day in China. And that gives Marvel and its distributor Disney significant bragging rights. But the China release is also about fighting piracy. The sooner you get a film to a massive market like China, the less encroachment on profits from bootlegging. China isn't just throwing its weight around at the movie box office. It's also increasingly the place other countries turn to for infrastructure loans, which allows Beijing to project soft power through hard steel and concrete. You can see that today as world leaders gather in Beijing for a summit on China's Belt and Road Initiative. It's a development strategy aimed at expanding China's links with dozens of countries through investment in infrastructure. But China is facing growing criticism over the initiative, says Mary Kay Magstad. She's the world's former China correspondent and host of the podcast, Whose Century Is It?
One big case that stands out that was sort of a warning signal for everyone else that was considering Belt and Road cooperation was Sri Lanka. It had a big deal with the Chinese government to build a port and build an airport. And when Sri Lanka couldn't make its payments, the Chinese government said, okay, well, one of the clauses in the loan was that if you couldn't make your payments, we would basically take possession of the port for 99 years and about 15,000 surrounding acres of land, and that'll repay some of your debt. Not all of it, but some of it. So I was actually in Malaysia last year, just before the elections. And what I was hearing, I mean, people were sort of coming up and talking to me, not even realizing I was a journalist, and saying, this election's really important because we don't want to be a colony again. You know, they saw what happened in Sri Lanka and they thought, okay, we get it. We need to be a lot more careful about not overextending ourselves.
So at this Belt and Road Initiative summit in Beijing, 30 world leaders, and Washington was hoping its allies would steer clear of the summit. So who's on the guest list and what does that list tell us?
The guest list is interesting. So it includes Russian President Vladimir Putin, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan, the Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. Germany and France are sending ministers, lower-level ministers. Basically, what it tells us is there are a lot of countries in the world that are interested in infrastructure cooperation with China, as long as the terms, they can come to terms that are mutually beneficial. That said, you know, European ambassadors to China last year wrote a letter to the Chinese government saying your approach to the Belt and Road build out in Europe is opaque. It's not serving the interests of European countries. And this isn't the way we do business. We would like to be involved in, you know, being able to bid on some of these contracts. Since that letter was written, and only Hungary abstained from it out of all of the European Union ambassadors, Italy has signed on. Portugal has signed on, Greece and Hungary had already come to deals with China. Switzerland is interested. So, you know, there will be some cooperation with China. And, you know, the United States, sort of the best way to deal with that, if you want to keep allies on side, is to offer something better, not to say, no, you can't do that. You know, just back away from that, but we're not going to do anything to help you.
So what can the U.S. and other nations do to counter this $1 trillion initiative? Or is Washington wrong to fear the Belt and Road Project?
Well, look, I mean, there's definitely competition between China and the United States right now. China, as a government, as an entity, as a political entity, has really not made much of a secret of the fact that it sees this as being its time, its century. That said, I don't think that it needs to be a zero-sum game. I don't think it needs to be go with China or go with the United States. And many countries in the world are basically voting with their feet and saying, we don't want to have to choose. When we see a good deal coming from China, you know, we'll check it out and make sure it's actually a good deal. But if it works for us, we're going to do it. And dozens of leaders of those countries have come to the Belt and Road Summit and want to show the Chinese government, you know, we're actively listening. Show us what you got.
Mary Kay Magstad is the world's former China correspondent. She's also the host of the podcast, Whose Century Is It? Good to speak with you again, Mary Kay. Thanks.
Great to talk to you, Marco. Thanks.
Quiet, meditation, introspection versus noise, distraction, and looking at screens. That's what you'd assume to be some of the differences between medieval monks and us 21st century citizens. What do we have in common, though? Here's Jamie Kreiner, a medieval history professor at the University of Georgia.
They often found that their brain jumped around, that they couldn't keep it still or focused on one thing.
Yep, distraction, you know? Like you might happen to be staring at your smartphone right now. If you are, please pay attention. Kreiner analyzed the writings of medieval monks in southern Europe, and she found that the monks, like mortals everywhere, would daydream. She figured that their minds often drifted away from the prayer, text, or song they were supposed to be focused on. They'd think about food, another person, or just stare out the window wondering what time it was. The medieval clock, by the way, would have been the sun. Kreiner has spent a lot of time studying the concerns and worries of medieval monks and their tendency to get distracted.
The biggest surprise for me in reading these materials, some of which are 1600 years old, is that distraction is something that people were wrestling with back then. And it wasn't even necessarily about tech at all. It was just about something inherent in the mind. The difference between us and them is not that we are distracted and they aren't, but that they actually had savvier ways of dealing with distraction, ways of training their minds the way we might train our bodies, you know, power through the more difficult moments of the day when the mind seems most jumpy.
One technique was deprivation, the key to a monastic existence. Detach from the things most people care about, like family, friends, work, day-to-day gossip. The idea was that if you don't detach, the memory of having done these things will distract you. But the more intriguing technique the monks used to avoid distraction was to visualize whatever they were studying or praying or singing about, a kind of visual mnemonic device. The more colorful and provocative, the better.
They were way more honest than we are, I think, about what the mind likes. They also weren't ashamed of saying, you know, make your images graphic, make them violent, make them involve sex, have them be gory, have people moving and gesticulating really wildly. They knew that's the kind of thing brains like to think about, and so why not harness that and be a little bit productive while you're doing that?
Productive, provocative, but focused. That's what we can learn from medieval monks, a good lesson today from the 10th century. And that is it for today. Stay focused, everyone. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.